Good morning, everyone. Boker Tov. Bruchim Habayim. Welcome. Special thank you to our guest this morning. Very, very much. Thank you to Rabbi Katz and Mrs. Began. This is the third year in a row that the Kollel is getting together for this morning on Shavuos Batamuz, I believe, or the third in a series. This is also the third of our, the last in the series of our armchair conversations this summer. It's really been an amazing journey. The first conversation was focused on the life of the Lubavitcher Rebbe with his physician. The second conversation was our salute to service evening, which was really unbelievable to hear from a 95-year-old World War II veteran about his Jewish experience, sharing that conversation with an IDF soldier. And now this morning, the culmination. What a better way to think about the 3 weeks than to begin the period of time that we're focusing now on what it means to lose a Beis HaMikdash, because we don't really know what it means to have one, so we have to think about what that means. But our sages teach us, Chazal instruct us, that this period from the Second Temple perspective is one that should be focused on the root cause, and that is sinas chinam. Sinas chinam, literally translated as baseless hatred. Usually hatred has some kind of basis. A lot of times it has a lack of self-esteem or whatever it is, but the idea of sinas chinam, as Chazal identifies as the root cause of the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, gives us pause to think about what we can do, and that's why over the past several years we've taken the time out to gather together and to bring people who are devoting their lives to Avas Chinam, to loving other Jews and to inspiring other Jews and educating. And so this morning we have the privilege of hearing from two perspectives that maybe I'll let you each talk a little bit about where you come from and how you came to this pursuit, not just an avocation, but as a vocation of teaching and inspiring others, and how these two individuals, both Rabbi Katz and Mrs. Began, really personify and can be beacons for us of Avas Yisrael, so we can have a conversation about what is Avas Yisrael in our day and how do we celebrate it, how do we live it. So maybe just talk just a little bit about your own background, your own bio, and then we can get into the conversation just a little bit. Where you're from?
You didn't mention this to me.
That's not necessary. That you could do that you could do on your own.
I appreciate your brand, the warm welcome. I appreciate you mentioning the 92-year-old soldier because it made me feel young. Sensitive of you. In a nutshell, I come from a family where my mom came from a religious background, observant background. My dad did not. My parents met in around 1947, at a time where young men were not going towards tradition, but going away, unfortunately. And he met my mom, and my mom said that there's a few deal breakers here, like Shabbos kosher and Taras HaMishvacha and kids in day school. And my father saw a good deal, and he went for it, and I always say. And my father would always say, teach me what I didn't learn. We went to day school, went to yeshiva, and he said, teach me what I didn't learn. So I remember, I think it was in high school, maybe in ninth grade, I came home with this erudite, complex Talmudic presentation to share with my father at the table. And my father said, Moshe, that might be relevant to you. It's not relevant to me. So he forced and prodded us to come up with ways of presenting our timeless Torah in a way that people without extensive backgrounds can appreciate. And he would critique it constructively and primarily would say, Moshe, keep it short. So today I try to do, and it actually required a lot of work because things that resonated with me, with my background, etc., didn't necessarily resonate with my father, and wouldn't resonate with many American Jews. I think that's what sort of forced me or prodded me to try to develop the ability to present our timeless Torah in its pure form, but in a way that people with different backgrounds can understand and appreciate.
Speaking. A little, where are you coming from?
I've got to be honest because my sister's here. my sister and I, came from absolutely no tradition whatsoever.
Can you talk louder?
Yes. Yes, thanks for telling me at the beginning.
Is that mean I spoke loud enough or you weren't interested in what I was saying?
We came from no tradition whatsoever. So, to make a long story short, I always had a burning desire for anything Jewish. And I have background memories of specific incidents, like winding up at someone's home for Rosh Hashanah and smelling brisket or singing Shalom Aleichem at my friend's house in San Diego. I have these isolated memories, a Purim party in my hometown of Newton, Massachusetts. So from the onset, I understood that providing later on, decades later, providing powerful, loving memories to your fellow Jew, just even one beautiful brisket is so incredibly valuable, even if you burn it. So we grew up really with nothing, and I had a tremendous yearning for anything Jewish, and the long story short, after college, I went to Russia. And after this was right after communism fell, and because I had majored in acting, I wound up being the Jewish studies teacher at the new Jewish school in Moscow. So my students were the bar and bat mitzvah kids. So they're looking at me, and whatever I tell them Judaism is what it is. Of course, I have no idea what Judaism is. I could tell you very funny stories about how I found out, because this is obviously before technology and Google. MGU, the university library, the Soviet books were my information. So that propelled me to start searching. So my experience in Moscow actually began my journey of tshuva, and I started learning in Moscow, and then ultimately went to Israel. And that was in 1993. And I think that I really did what the understanding that we were slaves in Egypt, and that cardinal experience made an imprint on us and allowed us to have tremendous rachmanis for our people. I relate to that because I had to go through this experience of learning everything for the first time to understand what it means to teach to Jewish people who have never heard of anything. So I really understood it from my own personal experience, and that's been our mission, to teach and love and connect and form deep relationships with every Jew who comes across our path. My husband and I have an organization called L'Chaim Center. Some of our dear students are here and friends, and this is in Deerfield. And we're very excited. I'm excited to be here, and I've loved learning with Rabbi Brand every Monday morning. My sister and I never miss it.
Thank you. So for those who are just joining us, this is Mrs. Ali Beacon from the L'Chaim Center, Rabbi Moshe Katz from the Chicago Torah Network, and we're talking about Ahavas Yisrael. So maybe you could continue that a little bit in terms of, through your journey, how do you define, in your own terms, your own concept, how do you define what is Ahavas Yisrael?
Okay, I have to define the term for myself from an experience that I had. So I'm getting a little vulnerable with you here, but there's a reason for it. So we were very, very much struggling with my son behaviorally and going through a lot of really difficult stuff. One particular night was unbelievably difficult. I remember it was just 3 hours of tantrums and really just very, very painful. At a certain point, he just fell asleep out of like total exhaustion. And I lay on my bed, kind of crying, kind of just like at a loss. And then, you know, I hear a little coughing an hour later. And I go into his room, and he's fast asleep. And my heart wells up, and I say, I love this child so much. This child who's making me doubt myself and making me, like, not sleep at night. This child who is really creating a lot of chaos in the family, I love him so much. Not only do I love him so much, but boom, the next morning comes and I'm making him his favorite omelet and I'm doing everything that I need to do to get him ready for school. And I think inside of that story, and I learned this very much from Rav Noach Weinberg, who was my husband and my first teacher who founded Eshet Torah, he says that the fact is we do something very natural with our children. It's not about my daughter Talia that I'm telling this story. We do something natural with our children. There's a reason for it. There are two words that share a root. Rachamim, compassion, and rechem, womb. Something happens, sorry to the 50% that might not understand this analogy totally, but something happens in the rechem, in the womb, that creates such identification with the other that you love them no matter what. As Rav Noach said, you would never wake up and say, like, honey, you're going to leave now, and the Goldsteins are coming in, because they're very, very cute. They're next door, and, you know, I really just think they're fabulous kids, so it's really been nice to know you. Goldsteins are moving in, you know. You would never say that. We used to laugh at Rav Noach's joke, but it's really so profound. Because you share this total identification with other, you are there for them. Not only do you love them and have compassion for them no matter what, no matter what they do, you are ready to do for them. The reason is because you naturally look for their virtues. You naturally look for what's good for them. And that's how you know. You know that difficult kid, it's your friend's kid or your, you know, that other person's kid. Oh, they're so spoiled, they're so out of control, they're so this, they're so that, but when it comes to your kid, mother bear, right? You'll see the good. That's because there's such a profound identification that happens with our children. And Rav Noach Weinberg and Rav Yaakov Weinberg too, Zatzal, they used to remind us, extrapolate what you do naturally with your children to the rest of Klal Yisrael. Identify with them, come through with them, regardless of their behavior, have compassion for them, do for them regardless, and innately look for their virtues, just like you look for the virtues in your child. So that experience sort of resonates with me as like an essential definition of Ahavas Yisrael.
Thank you. What would you add to think about how to define Ahavas Yisrael?
Love juice.
It's not an easy thing.
No, one great Hasidic rabbi once said that the mitzvah to love Jews is not the Jews that make it easy to love them. You don't need a mitzvah for that. You need a mitzvah for those that sometimes make it a little bit challenging. I was thinking of a similar a metaphor to Ali's. She's right on the 50%. I don't totally get what she's saying. I think I do, to some extent.
Sure,
but I always say that if men had to have babies, the world would have ceased to exist thousands of years ago. So I think a similar metaphor would be twins. I don't have a twin. My father happened to have been a twin. Twins grew up in the same womb. Right? And there's a connection, there's a lifelong connection, a deep, intimate connection because of that. And all Jews grew up in the same womb. That womb was Mitzrayim, Egypt, it was Har Sinai, where we developed together into a people. And the mitzvah is to never lose sight of the fact that we're one. We're one because, spiritually speaking, our souls are all united. They're one. We're one because we share the same womb. We stood at Har Sinai. I joke with people when you meet someone and they look familiar, but you don't know where I ever meet you. If all fails, we met at Har Sinai 3,000 years ago. We literally did. Right, so the mitzvah is to remember that we have this common womb, and we have this common history, this common experience. The Rambam adds a few subtleties to the mitzvah. The Rambam says that you should love every Jew like yourself, and you should speak their praises. Speak positively. And actually, when the Rambam discusses the mitzvah to love Hashem, he also says that when we look at the world and appreciate Hashem's greatness and the beauty and the complexity of the universe, we will immediately love Hashem. And we will praise him, Shabeach Mufaya, we will praise him, and we will yearn, a deep yearning to know him. All right, so from this Rambam, I take out that one, the mitzvah is to love, but it has to be also expressed. You know, there's a reason that people who love each other will leave a little note, a love note. When you think about it, it's a little bit bizarre, like, you know, in case you don't know that I love you, I'm informing you that I love you. Is that what's going on? I once heard from a rabbi that a couple came to him and for counseling, and the woman said that he never tells me that he loves me. So the guy, being a guy, said, I told you when we first got married. No, I didn't think it was necessary to re-inform you of that, for that matter. But why do people do it? Not because they think the other person doesn't realize it, but because love needs to be expressed. If we don't express, it's not true love. So the Rambam says the mitzvah is to express the love through talking positively about them, the praises. And he tells us that part of the loving Hashem is to yearn to know him. I think that's also a fundamental part of the mitzvah, to love every Jew and to yearn to understand them. Because much of what makes Ahavas Yisrael challenging is because we don't get the other person. We don't get each other. And we need to want to know what makes them tick. What may sound perfectly logical and compelling to us may sound bizarre to them, we have to try to understand them in order to do this mitzvah. Finally, one last thing that my Rebbe Rav Huttner said, which also jives with what Ali was saying, is that he doesn't even bring any sources. It's axiomatic to him that the mitzvah to love other Jews includes wanting to be loved by other Jews. Because by nature, someone who is in love wants to be loved. That's part of feeling love. You want the person that you love to love you. Right, so we have to be conscious about when, you know, it's not enough if we say, well, I love all Jews. They think I'm crazy. They think I'm a fanatic. They think I don't consider them Jewish, but I love them, so I fulfill the mitzvah. You know, if I'm just saying, no, there's still something lacking here. Part of love is that you need to want them to love you, and to the extent that they don't at this point, then the mitzvah is not complete.
I wonder if even for those of us who sometimes were in a particular situation where, you know, it's difficult to cultivate that feeling, to really love that person. Even in the Rishonim have debated, is there such a thing that the Rebbe Shlomo can really be mitzvah you to cultivate a certain feeling, right? This is an old question. But even if we don't have that feeling, one, you know, you look to the Sefer HaChinuch, one could still be mekayim in a certain sense, some midah, some measure of Ahavas Yisrael, because the way that the Sefer HaChinuch frames it is that, very much like the Gemara describes, it's something that you don't want done to yourself, don't do to somebody else. Even if we don't necessarily love someone, or we certainly don't like them, but we could still treat them, we could still relate to them in a way that falls in the path of Avas Yisrael. I don't like it if somebody does such and such a thing to me. Well, I'm not going to pay that forward to somebody else. So I might not yet reach the Madrega that I really, when I see them, I feel like, oh, this is my child, or this is my twin brother. But maybe we could still be Mekayim some element of Avas Yisrael by the way that we treat someone. You know, if we're not yet at the level that we can deeply love them, maybe there could still be a kiyum of the mitzvah of Avas Yisrael, just in the way that we relate to them. And so the Sefer HaChinuch says, in terms of how we speak about people, I guess that fits with the Rambam of Lishabeach, you know, nobody likes it if somebody speaks badly about them. So I shouldn't speak badly about anybody else. And it's interesting also that he puts it in terms of financial terms. The same way that I look out for my own financial welfare, I don't want my investment to go bad. I wouldn't want, you know, if my car was outside, I wouldn't want to leave it open when the clouds are gathering. It's the same thing with somebody else. If you see somebody who their car door is open, so we should, you know, knock on their door. Even if, you know, I don't feel that connection, that tremendous ava to them, but I could start treating them that way. And I wonder if we focus on action items, things that we can do. So then, acharei ha'pu'ulos nimshachim halavavos. There's this concept that the more that you act in a certain way, you habituate to something on a practical level, so then that can have an effect on an internal level as well. That's a principle in the Sefer HaChinuch. And so Rav Dessler has in the Kunjas HaChesed that if there's somebody that you love, you give to them. And then so maybe even if we don't love somebody so much, so readily, but if we do for them and we treat them nicely, maybe that'll help cultivate within us a greater sense of appreciating that person, because you go out of the way to do something for them, it can help in the midah of Avas Yisrael. We can wonder, as some of you are noticing, you know, Rabbi Katz, he has a few more gray hairs than I do, so he has a lot more life experience than I do.
I'm implying that I have hair.
Rabbi Katz actually went to day school with my father. He's not that old. But
literally, more metaphorically, literally, in the same womb as his father.
So one of the things that we talked a little bit about before, the question of reflecting on is Avas Yisrael today, is it different, and how does it apply different today in, let's say, 2018 than it did in previous generations? I don't know if we have to talk about the 13th century, but how do you see the mitzvah of Avas Yisrael applying today? Is it in any way different than it was a generation ago or two generations ago? Or is it different than it was in different kufas? How do you see that? What do you think?
What do I think? I don't go back to the 13th century, but I have memories growing up. I grew up in I don't think the term existed then, a modern Orthodox shul in Brooklyn. And majority of the people were not Shomer Shabbos. It was an Orthodox shul. And they had a big Hebrew school. And in front of the shul on Rosh Hashanah, literally hundreds and hundreds of Jewish teenagers and kids and teenagers sat on the stoop in front of the shul. And Yom Kippur, when's the fest over? And it never dawned on anyone to reach out to them. Today, if 100 teenagers would be in front of Or Torah, or the Chicago Mekubo, or Rabbi Unger's shul, any shul in Chicago would grab the opportunity to reach out with love to these kids and try to engage them. But it was a different world. We just didn't think. No one. They were nice people. They were committed to Torah. They just never dreamt. They never thought, let's try to engage these people. I'm not sure they knew how to engage them either, but they didn't have. We didn't have that feeling. Today, that feeling is very, very prevalent. When we talk about loving every Jew, it used to be an asterisk. It used to be love every Jew, provided that they're on some level committed to the Jewish mission, right? Chazal specifically say that imcha b'mitzvos, you have to love a Jew that shares that in common with you the commitment to the mitzvos. That's the pure halacha, right? It's been established by some of the greatest gedolim. I believe the Chazon Ish, and foremost perhaps the Chazon Ish, was in Eretz Yisrael. He wrote very, very specifically, very clearly, that many of the approaches or attitudes that are mentioned in Chazal about Jews who are not observant don't apply today. They don't apply, and the response that was given also doesn't apply. It doesn't apply because he makes it very clear that the typical non-observant Jew is what we call a tinnik shenish, but they're not accountable for their lack of observance because they were robbed of their heritage and they don't really know. They don't know. I used to tell people a joke when they come to my class after a few weeks, you're getting close to that point. It takes a long time to get to that point. But so they're simply not responsible, right? And the Rambam says, and the Chazon Ish rather says, that sometimes strong responses that were in time of Chazal, right, was because the person was seen as a rebel. I think that some people who are privileged to be part of pre-war Europe, sometimes they still have this in their mind, this picture that a person is not observant is a rebel. But I think anyone that grew up in America knows that that's not that's not the case, including in most cases the rabbis. They're simply not. I meet a young woman. She says to me, "I'm studying to become a Reform rabbi." So I'm cordial. In my mind, I say that she must be a special person. She wants to serve the Jewish people. The best way she knows how is becoming a rabbi. That's unfortunate. She doesn't realize how much she can contribute to the Jewish world without necessarily being a rabbi. But I see something special there. And the Chazon Ish wrote the words that I think have been accepted throughout the religious Jewry, that the mission today is to bring those Jews closer with cords of love. Right. So in other words, the yelling at people, first they don't deserve to be yelled at, and yelling at them is not going to help. Somebody once asked Yaakov Weinberg, who was mentioned before, the big Rosh Yeshiva of Ner Yisrael, about the patching children, giving a patch to a kid. Not the abuse, God forbid, but the traditional patch. Because there are sources in Chazal that say that it's appropriate for a parent to do that. So he said it all depends on whether it's going to work. If it's going to help them develop the way they should be developed, then within reason it works. If it's going to destroy their self-esteem, it doesn't. It doesn't work. So it has to work. So the Chazon Ish says yelling doesn't work. They don't deserve to be yelled at, and it doesn't work. We have to draw them with cords of love. So today that asterisk is almost non-existent.
Any thoughts on that?
That makes absolute sense. Absolute sense in our generation.
It happens to be occasionally. It makes sense.
Yeah. No, it makes absolute sense. I was thinking that this generation is unique. Although this is not entirely true in the from world, it's largely true in the non-from world that the needs are less physical. It's less of, and again, there are many, many exceptions. But today, and I think of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which probably most of you know, that it's only when your most basic needs for air, food, water, shelter are met, then you can move on to security. Once security is met, you move on to the next need of love. And once love is met, you move on to the top need of self-actualization. And I think what we're seeing in our world is that as our generations go by and more physical needs are met, not again, with many, many exceptions, the most profound need people have is to be seen, to be validated, to be acknowledged, to be smiled at, to have you remember their name, to have you not check your phone when you're talking with them. I hate caller ID. I think it should be abolished. It's so rude. It's like, hold on, someone more interesting is calling. I'll be right back. you know, there's so much in our modern culture that speaks to alienation. So although, so whereas the post-Holocaust and before, there was so much physical need to be met, again, there's so much physical need to be met also today. But, you know, I think about our world in the North Shore, the Kirov that we do in Deerfield, it's not, by and large, with exceptions, it's not material. It is acknowledging another's existence with warmth and caring. It's validating. It's showing I care about you. It's showing I remember what's important to you. What's joyful for you is joyful for me. What's upsetting for you, I'm there for you. And I've learned through many, many mistakes, through missing many, many important things, that the most important thing we can do in the area of Ahavas Yisrael is being there for people, caring for people, smiling at them, recognizing and validating their very existence. And with Cords of Love, I have absolutely experienced that is true. Anytime I forget that, it flies back in my face. That really, in today's world, you know, it's funny. I can't remember what Musser sage said this, but he spoke about his generation as people not able to take real Musser. So that was a long time ago. All the more so, a million times over, this generation does not respond to negativity. This generation does not respond to rebuke. This generation responds to caring and high regard and love and seeing the good in someone. Absolutely, unequivocally. Anytime I forget two of those two truths, that people want to be validated and their existence acknowledged and they're very self-cared for, and to do it through positivity and love, when I lose my way and I forget either of those things, it backfires on me, and I see the person moving farther and farther away. So in my experience, we're really moving into a tekufa of our, especially with all of the technology, especially with everything we're fighting with technology, a tremendous psychological alienation, tremendous loneliness, and tremendous feeling of like almost, sometimes of like almost barely existing. So I think one of the most important aspects of Ahavas Yisrael is just truly caring for people, putting down your phone and calling people, putting down your phone and calling people, that's what I said. I will hold to that exact phrase. Put your phone down and call someone. So you know what I mean. That's my experience, and it wasn't the same after the war. It was their basic needs. It's different now. It's more psychological. It's more existential. It's more personal. And we really have to be there, and we have to care about people. You know, my husband and I are on the brink of moving to Deerfield. And we said, I'll still come to your class on Monday morning. And we said, you know, we were taking a walk yesterday on Shabbos, and we were saying, like, what do we want to, like as we enter into it, let's give some thought to our approach, even though we've been doing this for so long, like what? And we kind of came to the conclusion: care about people, bring them close with your genuine caring, with no agenda, with true love and high regard, and simply care about people. And that speaks more volumes than anything else. Unfortunately, this is not, again, and I'll be quiet. With some exceptions, and again, with exceptions, people aren't searching for truth the way they used to be searching for truth. It used to be like in our day, we had our backpacks on, we got to the hotel, and we're like, is there a God? And what difference does it make in the world? And then Rabbi Schuster would swoop in, and, you know, we'd go to the Heritage House, and before we were learning from Mati Berger all about God, and it was like, boom, all, you know, neurons were firing. Today, people aren't searching for Hashem in the same way, or they are, but it's buried under a lot of apathy or a lot of disconnect. They might actually be, but it's much more harder to pierce. So really, I think more than anything, it's about love today. It's about love and caring for the other. More than any theology, more than any classroom setting, it's about caring.
So you touched on technology, which I suspect over the coming years is going to change the landscape of how we, as you alluded to, how we actualize Ahavas Yisrael. Because this medium of loving people has to do with how to connect with people. And connecting with people is an interesting question as modes of connection change and shift. You know, you alluded to the challenge. Dr. David Pelkovitz, a renowned psychologist, he likes to point out that there is a challenge of technology where you have communication, but you don't necessarily have connection, or you have information without knowledge. So how to, you know, when people are in a virtual community, how to create a community of Avos Yisrael? Is it possible in a virtual community? And if it is, what are the new strategies that we need to figure out? It's something that we're probably going to be facing over time, how to get to connect to people in a meaningful way when people are so frazzled and so bifurcated and so fractured all over the place. Are there any, you know, I guess technology is one. Are there any other that you can think of that come to mind, barriers to Ahavas Yisrael, other that are age-old? I guess one of them, the most obvious one, is differences. You know, people are automatically on guard, or they're uncomfortable with differences. And we spend so much time as we grow trying to break down stereotypes and xenophobia and the uncomfortable feeling that we have about differences. Because we see somebody who's different from us, we automatically, instantly feel uncomfortable. Well, many of us, I shouldn't speak for everybody. But that's one barrier that leads to a challenge with Avos Yisrael, because I don't feel at ease with that person. I don't have such an automatic connection. I don't look at that person who comes from a different background and speaks with a particular accent that I don't have in common with them. I don't say, oh, you know, we were together at Sinai. And that doesn't necessarily well up when I sit next to that person on the plane, or I'm struggling to get the next spot in the parking lot. Like, these are just basic limitations. What, I don't know if there are those or others, the specific barriers, challenges that come up when we think about Avos Yisrael, and then we can figure out how to conquer them. Any specific barriers that you think?
Well, I think, as you said, differences obviously is something that makes it challenging. Whether the person is not observant, observable in a different way than I'm observant, a different derech, different path, that brings with it a challenge. To me, I always think to myself that we live in a very superficial world. Now, we judge people totally, some very often, by superficial things: what they wear, what they don't wear, what kind of hat. Yarmulke, hat, what kind, observant, not observant, which is not superficial. But we need to learn how to look deeper into people. I always like to tell a story about this fellow who's working in a shopping mall, and here's an announcement that whoever lost $10,000 wrapped in a yellow rubber band, come up to the service desk. Looking to himself, is my faith in humanity has been restored? That's amazing. Because you know? The end of the announcement was, we have your rubber band. so it's a cute story, right? But the thing is that the rubber band obviously has no value in itself, just the wrapper. And very often we meet people and we just focus on the wrapper, the rubber band, the externality. You know, whether it's with garb or religious garb, or whether it's what a person does for a living, are they quote accomplished, not accomplished, all types of things that are really external, superficial. And that's how we assess people. And we have to learn to look deeper and see virtue in people. Before we even get to Avos Yisrael, it's true about Tzelem Elokim. You know, we lose sight of that Tzelem Elokim in every person. On top of that, Avos Yisrael, we have to learn to look deeper and to see virtue. So I also deal with people who are quote not observant, and some of them are very, very distant from the heritage. But truth of the matter is, when you look deeply, there's so much Judaism in them, so much Jewish values in them. You know, I always tell people that I'm always very careful to translate all Hebrew terms. There are two Hebrew terms that I don't translate, because it's not necessary, and I'm proud of the fact that I don't have to translate them. One is tzedakah. You don't have to translate tzedakah. I think we're getting, unfortunately, close to the period where we may have to. But till now, you don't have to translate tzedakah. Every Jew knows what tzedakah is. And the word mensch. Mm-hmm. You don't have to translate what the word mensch means, right? And so I see a person, I say to myself, I want to love that person. That person, to no fault of their own, is limited in their exposure, but they still have this Jewish kishka feelings that are part of our value system. You know, recently, Stephen Hawking, who passed away, the great physicist, Right, so he's a person that we have to admire because of his limitations and what he became despite his limitations, but we have Jewish people had issues with him. He was he's an atheist, he boycotted Israel to some extent, but he left he was asked in an interview, what is the charge you want to give to your children? And he answered three things. He said something to the effect, don't look at them, but look up at the stars, that's fine. And if you ever find love, don't lose it. And third, love your work, because work makes your life meaningful. So you can discuss any one of those things. But when I sit down with people, I tell people, Jewish people, they may be so removed from our heritage. Do you find there's something missing here? A great mind was asked to give a charge to his children. Is there something that's missing here? And with a little prodding, I find that every Jew fills in the blank. I said, aren't you surprised that you don't find you should be a mensch, something about about what kind of person they should be, right? And virtually every Jew responds to that because in their kish, because they have these feelings. I was once in Milt's restaurant, and a fellow became observant through CTN, was there with his dad, his quote secular dad. So I always like to go over to the parents, you know, and bond with the parents. I said, you raised a real mensch. He had such a Jewish answer. You know what his answer was? So far. So we have so little in common religiously, but at the core we share this, and it just shows the power of our heritage that people are so distant, they still have this. So to me, when I say try to love somebody despite the fact that they're so disconnected, if we look deeply, we'll find that most of our fellow Jews, brothers and sisters, on a certain level, there's such Jewish values that they still have. And I always tell people, I'll end with this. Sometimes people say to me, "What did you do to my kid? I had a normal, well-adjusted kid. You made him into religious." You know, usually it's in jest, at least partially. But so I like to get their attention. I say to them, you know what? It's your fault. My fault. I don't want them to be observant. I said, the answer is that why is it your fault? Because you taught them so many things. You taught them values. And sometimes they do it, they not realize that those values had a name. It's called Torah. What we call secular Jews raise their parents, their children, with so much Torah, they just don't know that it's Torah. You know, when I give a workshop about the laws of Lashon Hara, so it's pre-select. Who comes to that workshop? Good people want to become better. But bad people don't want to become good. Good people want to become better. So when someone comes to that class, I know something about their parents. I know that they grew up with it. That you know, and sometimes they'll tell me, my mother never spoke Lashon Hara, never a word, you know. So, you know, with the importance of having guests, you know. So there's so much Jewish within what we call secular Jews that I think if we look deep, we'll find it. And that is a good reason to want to love them.
Thoughts on barriers to Ahavas Yisrael today?
I think the greatest barrier can be found in the verse, V'ahavta l'recha kamocha, like yourself. That today, I don't feel there's enough healthy, accurate self-love. And a person can only love to the degree that they have healthy, accurate assessment of their own selves. And when a person doesn't love themselves, when a person is kind of committed to a limiting belief that they're not enough, that they're inadequate, that they aren't good enough, that they're not whatever enough, that will be the lenses through which they see the world. So really, it is almost impossible to love your fellow Jew unequivocally, unconditionally, if you don't have that same healthy love for yourself. Healthy love in a world where there's so much comparison. I would love to conduct a study about like the unhappiness barometer shoots up when a person goes on Facebook, right? Whatever you're missing, you might be missing a spouse or missing children or grandchildren, maybe you don't like your nose or your financial situation. Whatever you relate to as lacking in your life, you see that multiple fold on Facebook. I'll never forget, there was this girl, she was on Facebook. She came to a class of mine, and she's looking at this party. And she says, oh my gosh, everyone except for me is so well-adjusted, and they're having such a good time, and everyone's like so happy. Wait a second. I was at that party. That's me, right? She saw herself in the photo. Because it's such an illusion. And yet, people are tripped up by it. They're tripped up by it. I have pretty much made a commitment to myself to only use Facebook for professional purposes and then get off. Because I think it's toxic, and I think it creates an environment of self-doubt and inadequacy. And we have a culture of of a lack of healthy self-love. And that's buried in the pasuk. You can't love others without loving yourself. Loving yourself is a precondition. So that's number one. Number two is menuchas ha-nefesh, of just emotional well-being. I think that today, like Rabbi Brand alluded to, this running and this kind of fraction, you know, kind of compartmentalized and feeling kind of not whole and just running. And, you know, the first thing you do, maybe you say moda ani, maybe you don't, and then there's your phone. And we're not giving enough time to, and we learned this actually in your class very much, which Rosh Shlomo Volbe talks tremendously about a healthy self coming from quiet time, coming from the ability to be alone with oneself and like oneself, take walks, connect to Hashem. There's just a healthy self-love and a quietness and a slowing down that's very much missing in our culture. And as we learn in all Musar texts, consciousness precedes choice. Consciousness comes before choice. If you're not particularly conscious of life and of oneself and others and the greatness of life, then you're not really making choices. You're just kind of making, you're just rolling into your animal soul. You're just rolling into your choice, conditioned choices. You're just kind of rolling with your choices. So what it means by consciousness precedes choice is slow it down. Slow it down and think to yourself about what matters in your life, what's important in your life. And the Ari says, before you daven in the morning, you should verbally commit to loving one's fellow Jew like you love yourself. And your prayers will have more merit, they'll bear more fruit through that consciousness. But I think the way we can understand that Ari today is there has to be more consciousness in your life. There has to be more menuchas ha-nefesh. Menuchas ha-nefesh means calmness of the soul. If you're running and racing and reacting and just rolling into your choices, habituated, you're not making decisions. And I think that that's the culture that we live in now and we're moving into even more. So I think these two aspects of emotional well-being, menuchas ha-nefesh, and healthy self-love are very connected. Really, a person can only love themselves through calming down and slowing it down and reflecting on their Tzelem Elohim and other Tzelem Elohim. But in our rushed culture, that's getting more and more elusive. We have to fight for it. It's a little bit like going up a down escalator. If you want to make it happen, you have to make it happen. You have to prioritize it. So, and you talked about how do we, in our hyper... in our hyper-tech culture, like how are we making the connections? I still say, granted I'm the most lousy marketing, I'm the worst marketer on the planet, so I can't speak for much expertise, but I will say, put the phone down and call someone. I still say that. We have to be counter-cultural revolutionaries a little bit and really seek out human connection today more than ever.
So maybe just to pick up on these themes together, actually, you know, talking about self-love and maybe the idea at its core of self-esteem, mm-hmm. Right. Because what Rabbi Katz alluded to before relates to that very much in the sense that Avos Yisrael, you know, the experts, so to speak, in Avos Yisrael here at this table are primarily focused on, you know, the conversation about the Jew who's out there, who's not observant. Well, Avos Yisrael sometimes actually is even more challenging to the Jew who's in here, to the Jew who is in the community, but maybe stakes out a little bit of a different space. And so sometimes the challenge of Avos Yisrael comes to from someone who, let's say, I may wear a hat, but my hat is a straw hat, and the next person wears a beaver hood, you know, like a Chassidish hat, or they wear a gartel, and I, you know, so there's a lot of times a challenge of Avos Yisrael for people who are, let's say, more observant than I am, or their observance takes a different form. We may be just as observant, but I have a particular approach to Yiddishkeit, and they have a different approach to Yiddishkeit. And so sometimes my discomfort, my lack of Avos Yisrael, is not manifest, it's not an issue in the context of relating to a totally secular Jew I sit next to on an airplane. There, it's easy. You know what? It's more difficult when I see somebody at, you know, such and such a place, and then I start to feel uncomfortable. Someone once told me that the person to the left of you is a sheketz, and to the right of you is a frumak. So I guess that's always an interesting way of, you know, looking. You can always, every barometer is in relation to where you are. That's the, you know, I'm always in the center. I'm the
person
center.
Drawing fierce and eyes reckless, and the person is
right. So that is also a challenge. How to create Avas Yisrael for people who are in different places, and that partly comes back to the self-esteem. That as an individual, on the one hand, I have to be striving to do better, and as a community, we need to set high standards for ourselves. But at the same time, we have to have self-esteem. If we have a Masorah, and we have Rabbeim, and we have teachers and texts, and a whole worldview, a Torah worldview that informs us, we have to be proud of that. And if we have a healthy, balanced Torah self-esteem, then we don't need to look down on the people who are quote-unquote to the left of us or to the right of us, because we have something special to be proud of. There's no need to be uncomfortable. Why should we be uncomfortable? We have something that we know is authentic. We know that it's compelling. We know that it is time-honored all the way back from Sinai. There were 12 tribes at Sinai. Then there was a 13th for the, you know, miscellaneous Chevra. So we're one of the 12. There are another 12, another 11 or 12. Gesunta hate. Why should we be uncomfortable because somebody is different? It's only if I'm not confident in who I am and what I stand for and what my Masorah is, then I'm going to start getting all worked up and very uncomfortable. And then I feel the need to put this one down and put that one down. Why do you have to put anybody down? Gesunta hate. In this community, Baruch Hashem, I tell people we're very blessed. I think we're one of 7 kolim. There are 2 Chassidish kolim, and then there's the Chicago community kolim, and this. There are tons of kolim. Nobody has to feel a sense of discomfort or lack of self-esteem because there are other kolim. Every Masorah has its identity, and we have to be proud of that. And if we are proud of that, then we wouldn't feel the need to start denigrating other people. We should be proud of what we have, and then we should appreciate the fact that there's diversity. It's great that there are 7 kolim in this community. Ashreinu Matov Chalkeinu, how many communities in America have these number of Jews who are committed to upholding a high standard of Yiddishkeit and embracing it in the community? Terrific. So I think it comes back to this idea of self-esteem in how we can appreciate everybody. Maybe we'll take just a moment for a closing thought, and we can open it for a final question or two. So maybe just a regalachas, one last thought.
I tell two short stories.
Great.
That I think to me epitomize what we're talking about, both in terms of the Rabbi Rent's most recent point and also about the people that are less connected. One of my favorite stories about Avos Yisrael is there's a person called Yosef Friedenson. I'm sure nobody recognized that name because he was the editor of a Yiddish magazine, the Yiddish version of Jewish Observer, and I don't think we're big Yiddish magazine readers here, including myself. And he came from a Hasidic Polish family. And when he passed away, he was interviewed, before he passed away, usually it happens that way, before he passed away, he was interviewed, and he had a brother named Shamshon Raphael. Shamshon Raphael, if anyone knows, is familiar with Rav Hirsch, the great German Torah leader and one of the greatest commentaries in the history of our people. And he was a German Jew. So when somebody's name is Shamshon Raphael, it usually means that they stem from that German background. How did you come that your father was a Polish Hasidic Jew? How did you come to name a child Shamshon Raphael? So he said that his father was a businessman, and he came to Frankfurt, Germany on business. And he saw for the first time, he saw a new phenomenon. He saw Orthodox women that were doctors and lawyers, and meticulous, but every aspect of observance, a deep religious life integrated together with their profession. He never saw that before. And he said to himself, if Rabbi Hirsch can make a community like this, he wants to name a child after him. He was able to see a different derech, a different path, right, and see the virtue and beauty of it to the extent that he named his child after the Rabbi Hirsch. And on top of that, it's important to know that he would not have been happy if his daughter would become a doctor or a lawyer. He would not want that for his daughter. But he was able to see this is a different path, and it's so overwhelmingly beautiful that I'm going to name a child after the rabbi of that community. One other story I want to share with you. I think it's a beautiful story, so I can't resist. Is it okay?
You don't need my permission.
The this story, someone I know in the community who comes from a family, an Israeli family, that very distanced from our heritage. I believe that the father didn't eat fish on Yom Kippur, totally very removed from our heritage. And three or four of the siblings became religiously observant. And they were students of Rav Volba, we mentioned before. So Rav Volba, not everyone knows this. He was a great Musar teacher of our generation. He also was of German origin, and he had a degree in psychology, and he was a very worldly person. So when the first child in this family got engaged, they had a l'chaim, a celebration, in the parents' home. Right, the parents were very secular and very cultured, sophisticated people. So Rabbi Volba came along to celebrate, brought some boys with him. So first he brought a fellow to play piano. So the parents could see that a person, a yeshiva boy, can play piano and be cultured. Then he spoke and he peppered his remarks with Latin phrases that he knew that the parents would resonate with the parents. And then he would have casual interactions with the parents at different family simcha celebrations. Fast forward, when the father turned 60 years old, so the kids say they want to have a big spiel to celebrate his 60th birthday. He said, no, he doesn't want a big thing. He said, just the kids. He said, if Rav Volba would come, that would be nice. Rav Volba never gave a word of Musa to him, never a word of rebuke. He just showed him. He showed him love and warmth and compassion, and showed him that a person could be rooted in Torah and be part of this world. And this person who was so secular would say, if Rav Volba would come, that would be nice. So fast forward a little bit more. So they had a party with the parents, the kids, and Rav Volba. So to me, that sums up our mission in this world, to make a Kiddush Hashem, and that every person that we encounter should admire what we stand for, and icing on the cake if they want to come to the birthday party.
Any final thoughts?
Well, we'll call this a Yiddish story, but I don't know if it's Yiddish, but it should be Yiddish if it's not. So, once upon a time, there was a traveler walking down a road, and he sees a wise man. And he says to the wise man, tell me, wise man, what are the people like in the town that I'm about to enter? And the wise man says, well, what were the people like in the town that you came from before? And he says, ugh, stingy, greedy, superficial, terrible. And the wise man says, so too are the people of this town. He keeps walking, and the wise man sees another person. And the next person says, wise man, tell me, what are the people like in the town that I'm about to enter? And the wise man says, what were the people like in the town where you came from? And he says, wonderful, kind, generous, loving, good, giving people. And the wise man says, so too are the people in the town you're about to enter. Same town, same people. It's entirely about our attitude. It's entirely about the frame through which we see reality. It's so much, it's so little of it is about what's out there. So much is about how we're feeling inside. So taking responsibility for Ahavas Yisrael means taking responsibility for the lens through which we're seeing the world. And choosing to see not only Tzelem Elokim, but the essential nature of the Jewish people, which from an esoteric level is one, or a Hasidish level, or whatever, a more spiritual level, is one soul. But on a more practical level, it's so important to understand what we are, that we're not a religion. We're not a religion in essence. You can be totally irreligious, and you can be just as Jewish as anybody else. And we're not a race. You can't, you know, you as you just walk on Ben Yehuda Street, you'll see every single color, every single, and we're not a culture. There's a million different, there's the culture of Yemen, and there's the culture of Morocco, and we're not a shared language. Yes, there's Hebrew, but many, many Jews don't speak Hebrew. We are none of those things in essence. In essence, what we are a family. We are a family. We are a people. More importantly, for our framing, we are a family. We are the B'nai Yisrael. So, of course, Yisrael was Jacob. We are the children of Jacob. We're all the same. We are all in the same family. And I think that recognizing that and loving ourselves, and I'm just sort of like, you know, kind of calling some of the points that I felt, I personally felt important, loving oneself, slowing down, having a certain amount of consciousness about loving one's fellow Jew as before one enters one's day, and understand that you are responsible for the frame through which you're looking at your life and you're looking at your fellow Jew. It's the same person, it's the same town, and the question really is, what's going to be your lens? And that's the question you have to ask yourself. And that's the mandate of Ahavas Yisrael. Through which lens am I looking at this person? Not what they're doing. It's not about what they're doing. It's about the lens through which I'm looking at my reality. And I think that's just incredibly important to remember at all times. And you'll forget, but one day you'll remember. Something will happen and you'll remember it. And I think it makes all the difference.
Thank you. Any questions, comments, or observations? We'll close.